My name's Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic. And I am sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the primary purpose of helping drunks. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that's... Sometimes I don't even believe that. You know, that's like... I remember the guy... I was the guy... My first sponsor, when I asked him to sponsor me, had 15 years, and I just looked at him like, that's impossible. That's impossible. I want to thank the committee for the graciousness. George picked me up at the airport. He already thanked himself for that. I don't have to say anything. And all the other members of the committee were been very gracious to me and very kind. And there was a scene in the airport. It's etched into my brain, where Megan's standing there next to Georgia holding a sign that says Georgia prepaid, and I just had to say, how much? How much? I mean, I well, inquiring minds want to know. Really want to welcome the new people. Glad you're here. Especially William. Were you still here, William? Oh, good. Glad you made it. I'm glad you're... William, I want you to know something. You know, this is different here. It's the only place on the planet I know of that'll give you a prize and a standing ovation for recently burning your life to the ground. You won't get that anywhere else, I'm telling you. Now, don't be too disappointed when you go to your home group and they don't do that. I mean, it's... I was impressed with a lot of long-term sobriety here. I've been to conferences where you get up over 30 years. There's not many people. I wonder, where are they? Yeah, Georgia, right? I belong to a home group. We have 4 members sober over 50 years. Yeah, I do H&I meetings every week with a guy that's 50, over 53 years sober, and he's really active in AA. And I need to have people around me like that. You know, they're the people I aspire to be like if I ever grow up. Let's see. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say, because I have no idea. I give up trying to figure it out. I pray like hell and just hope something happens. And, I don't know why I ended up alcoholic. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. My mother and father were just really nice people. They were principled. They were ethical. They were involved in altruistic charitable organizations. They were church people. They had a lot of respect. They were very nice and kind, and they sacrificed for me. It was a wonderful childhood, except that I was in it. And there was something wasn't right about me, and I couldn't have told you what it was, except that I remember, as far back as I can remember, these feelings of like a driven disconnectedness. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like other people look, and I feel driven to remedy this, and I can't remedy it, and I don't know what's wrong with me. I worry a lot. I'm always, what other people are thinking about me is a big piece of mental business with me. And I don't feel right. There's an awkwardness about me. I remember, God, the first day in kindergarten, and I hadn't found alcohol yet, but I needed a drink. Man, did I need a drink. Oh, my God. I remember all those kids, and I don't know. They're all thinking something. I don't know what they're thinking. I suspect it's about me, but I don't know. And oh my God. And my mother used to say to me before, when I was just a little kid, she'd say, I didn't know what she meant. She'd say, Rob, you're full of yourself. And one time she said to me, she said, you think you're the center of the universe. I went, and I must have been like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. But I suppose there's a lot of neurotic, insecure people with emotional problems that aren't alcoholic, I guess. But what makes me an alcoholic is what happened to me when I was, for the first time, when I was almost 13 years old, and I was with a bunch of older kids, and it was the first time I ever drank, and all this squirminess inside of me that I've been trying to cover up. You know, I'm the guy talks about in the book, in chapter Into Action, where we create the double life. I was that guy before I ever picked up a drink. I'd become the pretend guy. I became the guy who pretended he wasn't afraid, and I was afraid a lot. I became the guy who pretended he fit when I'd never felt like I fit. I became the guy who pretended he was cool, and I wasn't cool. I pretended like there wasn't anything wrong with me, and there's a bunch wrong with me, and I don't know what it is. I just live it. And so I put that facade up, and I'm with these older kids, and we have a bottle of Seagram 7, and we're passing it around. We stole from somebody's house, and I don't even know. I'll tell you, I don't even know that alcohol gets you high. I don't even know anything about it. I never saw my parents drunk. I had a couple uncles that people in the family would talk bad about because they were labeled alcoholic, but I don't even really know what that is. I don't know much about it except that these kids are into it and I want their approval so bad that I'm in. And they started passing this bottle around, and when you're coming from behind and you secretly feel like you're nothing, you got to look at the people that look like they're something, watch what they do, and then try to emulate what they do. And I'm watching these kids, and I noticed that the kids that took a big hit off this bottle of Seagram 7 seemed to get a lot of attention from the other kids. So by the time it gets to me, I'm in. I'm going to take a big hit. I'm just glad it's not cat urine, because I'm in. I'm telling you. I'm going to take a big hit off this bottle. And I did. And nobody talks about the burning. Oh, my God. I remember to this day. It was like acid eating out my insides. And somehow I kept it down. And when the burning stopped, something happened to me that I would seek for years. A feeling came over me, and whatever that was, that horrid, invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself seemed to dissolve away, and for the first time in my life, I could come out and play. For the first time in my life, I started to feel like they looked. Wilson said it best in his story when he said, I was a part of life at last. It's almost as if I've been doing time up until the time I had my first drink. And you know, you don't know you feel bad till you feel good. And I'll tell you, I remember this feeling, and I'm laughing with these guys, and after a couple drinks, I suspect I'm their leader. And you know, and I mean, it was so amazing. I remember thinking to myself, I want to feel this way the rest of my life. And I tried to. But when you're a kid, you can't get drunk every day. But I got drunk every chance I could get. The people in the suburban area that I grew up in used to keep their cases of beer. They put some beer in their refrigerator, and then they have a couple cases in their garages, which were on the alleys. We cured them of that. We'd go up and down the alley with a little red wagon and just take off. We'd take them to this fort, you know, that we built, and we'd just get drunk, man, you know, and I loved it, but I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know it, and something's wrong with me, and I don't know it, but I start getting in trouble pretty early, with such frequency and such seriousness by the time I was, right before my 16th birthday, I was standing in Judge Hess's chambers, and he's the juvenile court judge in the town I live in, and this is my third time in there. And my mother and father, who loved me and would have done anything to help me, are in that courtroom desperately trying to save me from being sent away somewhere with a horrid reputation for abuse for kids. And they made a deal with the judge, and I had to go somewhere else for a while that wasn't as bad, and I could get a good education there, and it was a very strict place. And back in those days, if you were an alcoholic teenager, they didn't have rehabs. You had juvenile detention centers, and then you had, if your parents could handle it, you had these schools, military academies, and schools run by priests with a high discipline and everything. I got sent to one of those places. Little did I know that all the screwed up kids in the country are getting sent there. So it was like a homecoming of sorts, I suppose. And I remember being there. I wasn't there very long, like a couple days, and I'm trying to fit. And I've been sober now for several weeks because I'm in trouble. You know, it's easy to stay sober when you're in trouble. I'm in trouble. But I just feel so awkward there and so uncomfortable. And so when you're secretly nothing, you got to look for the people that look like they're something and side up to them, hoping some of their something's going to rub off on some of my nothing, right? And I targeted these kids. These older kids looked like they had it going on. And I'm talking to this one kid one day, telling him about the trouble I'm in, you know, and enhance it a little bit. Because when you're not enough for you, you can't be enough for them. So you got to make it a little bigger, a little more dynamic. Right, I'm doing all that. You know, I'm not the only pathological liar in this room, I can tell for sure. And I'm doing all that. And this kid stops me and he says to me, "Oh, so you like to party, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do." I was hoping he was going to pull out a pint of 151 rum. You know what I'm saying? I love that one. That 151 rum, take you downtown now. I like that stuff. Instead, he doesn't pull out nothing. Instead, he starts talking bad about alcohol. He said, "Well, that alcohol make you stupid." And I'm backing up now because that's the only thing I've ever found my whole life that just lit me up and did for me what I need to have done. And he's bad rapping. He says to me, "Now I'm in trouble from drinking, a lot of trouble, and I get that. But quitting, out of the picture, that ain't even an issue." And he said to me, "What if I told you I could give you something that'd make you feel as good as that liquor, only they won't smell it on your breath, you won't stagger, you won't slur your words, nobody will even know you're high, and you keep a whole week supplying a little baggie. What would you say to that kid?" I don't even know what he's talking about, but I said, "Well, sign me up." And he introduced me to drugs. Let me tell you something. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics should not do drugs. It's really, really bad, man. I do them alcoholically, you know, and I just, oh, my God. And just in a couple short years, I burnt my life to the ground with that stuff to come back to what was safe and reliable and like alcohol. Wow. But, you know, the book says it. The book says that most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be anything but an alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict. There's a little panache in that. I mean, there's rock stars that are drug addicts, for God's sakes. There's nobody that wet their pants that I looked up to. I'll be a drug addict, but I don't want to be an alcoholic. My uncle's pathetic. He's an alcoholic. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be a mental health case. I mean, if you're a mental health case, you get pills. That doesn't sound so bad to me. I'll be a mental health case, but I don't want to be an alcoholic. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And I argued. I tell you, looking back, it's astounding to me that I spent as much mental energy proving to myself and anyone that was around time and time again that I'm not alcoholic. Nobody else does that. Chinese people don't go around trying to prove they're not Chinese. I mean, it's you know, it's like you are what you are. And people are, and I got sicker and sicker arguing with the truth about me that I had alcoholism. I always had it. But I didn't know it. I had it for all those years. A reaction to alcohol that defines us. I've always had it. And isn't it odd that I could always have that reaction to alcohol for years and never saw it? And what is that reaction? Well, yeah, I could tell you the terminology in the book, and you know, physical allergy, phenomenon of craving. But really, experientially, what that is every time, every single time I've ever drank alcohol, as the effect from the alcohol hits me, I break out in an irresistible yearning for more. I've always had that. That defines me as an alcoholic. I never in all the years I drank, and even the couple years I screwed around with drugs, I always had that reaction to alcohol. I can't tell you one episode, one time ever, where I was partying with a bunch of guys, maybe shooting pool, doing shots and beers, have one of my buddies or the bartender say, "Hey, Bob, would you like another drink?" And stand there and think to myself, "No, this is good, thanks." I've never had that experience, not once. And so if you can't get enough, you're going to have too much. It's just the way it is. And I loved it in the early years. And I mean, when you think of what, when you look back, and I'm sure most of the people in this room have had that experience of how alcohol at one time, before it turned on you, how it set you free. And it set me free. It was amazing. I could come out and play. I could talk. Oh, my God, I could talk to girls. I can't talk to girls sober. But you get me half lit up, I start channeling people and stuff. It's amazing, man. I would say things. I don't even know where the words are coming from, but it's very cool. Oh, I can't dance at all. I'm very clumsy and awkward, and everybody's looking at me. You get me half drunk, and the rhythm of the universe flows through me, man. I can dance. In later years, I could play the guitar and sing. I could sing in a band and play in a band. I couldn't do that sober. They're all looking at me. Alcohol set me free. And I suspect that if at one time alcohol had never done that for me, then I would, years later, when it turns on you and it starts doing what it's doing to me, I'd have never let it do to me what it was going to do to me if at one time it hadn't done for me what it had done for me. And I'm chasing it. And I'll tell you something that almost killed me. I think it kills a lot of us. That I'm basically a hopeful person. Now, doesn't that sound weird? Because hope's supposed to be an asset. But when you have a lot of hope, and it comes to alcoholism, it'll about kill you. Because the hope is that someday, some way, I'm going to control and enjoy this deal. And I don't want to give up the ghost, even though I went into the last couple years was hideous. I'd drink in depression and self-pity. I'd drink in loneliness. I'd start drinking. I'd stop bathing almost immediately. Well, I'm busy. Stop bathing. I don't drink socially anymore. I hole up. My idea of getting drunk is to hole up somewhere with a half gallon of vodka or a gallon of Richard's Wild Irish Rose and seek oblivion. That's the end of my drinking. And yet, you get me 4, 5, 6 months sober in a halfway house or recovery house, and I start fancying that I can, because the hope is I'm going to be able to jumpstart that party and get back to the good old days when it was magic. And I don't want to give that up. It's killing me, but I don't want to give that up. Because the truth is, I got nothing else. You know, and I don't understand what's wrong with me. I don't, see, after several years of relapsing throughout the mid-70s, I finally got to that point where I knew that I'm the one you're talking about now. Now, I couldn't have said allergic reaction and phenomenon of craving, but I got it, man. When I pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. I ain't done till the gorilla's done. You know what I'm saying? And you can tell yourself all night long, you know, me and the gorilla are just going to have a dance. No, you're not. No, it's going to be bad. And I get that. And I get that. And I think... And here's the kind of ego I have. My ego is always fancied that knowledge was power. I think knowing that and making up my mind and meaning it that I'm not going to take the first one, man, I fancied I was out of the woods. And I got to tell you something. I entered into the most horrific, degrading, degenerating years of my life was knowing I was an alcoholic and making my mind up that I'm never going to drink again. And I'd always go back to it eventually. You see, It's not just that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I got an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And I can't see it because it's vague and it goes right below the horizon and just gnaws at me. I Silkworth says it pretty good. He says, guys like me, when we quit drinking, I'm restless. I don't know that I'm restless. I just can't get settled anywhere. You know what I mean? Did you ever get that feeling like you're somewhere and you know, it's not where you need to be. You don't know where you need to be, but it ain't here. I'm irritable, but I don't want to admit to myself I'm irritable, because the truth is, irritable people irritate the crap out of me, man. I'm telling you. And I am not irritable. I can't help it that every time I get sober, I just see how stupid everybody is, you know? Oh my God, it's a gift everywhere I look. Stupid people everywhere, stupid people. Oh my God, I go to work and work with stupid. They looked like a good job when I got it. I'm not there very long. There's some stupid people there, man. I'm telling you. Go in traffic. There's traffic is full of stupid people. Oh my God. Do you ever go to the grocery store? Stand in the checkout line. Do you ever look at what other people buy? A gallon of ice cream and a six pack of Diet Coke. There's some stupid people in the grocery store. And then they make you go to these AA meetings. Oh my God, they got the stupid people grouped right here. Oh my God, I'd sit there. Alcoholics Anonymous was intellectually offensive to me. I mean, I've had a lot of therapy. I even worked in the field for a while. Actually, I was a very good drug and alcohol abuse counselor until the day I lost the job for being drunk on the job. True story. But I go to AA meetings, and it's you guys. First of all, I remember sitting there. I burnt my life to the ground. Like William, I've just ruined everything. Again. I hate that word, don't you? Again, Bob. I ruined it again. And I'd be sitting there, and I would just listen to these endless litanies of gratitude. Oh, my God. It's like people in AA grateful for everything. I'm not grateful for anything. I'll pretend. The truth is, I don't like anything. I don't like me. Matter of fact, I loathe me. And was it any wonder that I secretly hate myself? If someone else would have done to my family and my loved ones what I did to them, I'd try to kill them. So my feelings of self-loathing that I try to cover up with a lot of ego are not a surprise to me today. And I'm in AA with all these people are just grateful for everything. Oh, did you ever have somebody come up to you? Oh, it drives me crazy. People come up to you and say, has anyone told you they loved you today? Oh, I go, no. Well, I do. I wouldn't say nothing because I don't want a problem, but I just think, I hate you. Right. Oh, and then everybody's talking about God. God. Oh, God changed my life. God did this. God did. Oh, stop it. Oh, God. I'm a wannabe atheist. And I'm not really an atheist because I know some real atheists. You have to be very religious about being an atheist. I can't get that much angst about it, the truth. But here's what I am. I'm secretly a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy to this day that if I suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. You know what I'm saying? Right. And with God, I don't measure up with God. I'm just too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I can be good for a while and then it's like I outgood myself or something and I got to go be bad. I can't help it. You look at my track record, it's like I'm really good for a little while and then, oh boy, Bob goes in way off the deep end then. And I'm that guy. I can't measure up. And you know, I knew about God. I had a lot of religious upbringing. I remember this nun. I had this one nun. I'm a little kid, grade school. I'm trying to be good. I really am. And I think God, you know, they're saying God loves me. And then they talk about is God judges you. And it's confusing to me. And this nun. She was a young nun. She's kind of pretty, but she had all that gear on, you know. And she, I swear she'd be looking at me. She'd say this all the time. She'd, "You must be pure of thought, word, and deed." I go, "Yes, sister." And then my mind would start imagining what she looked like naked. And there's not a sin in the books for that, for God's sakes. I know. They don't even, nobody talks about that. That is like, wow, you're really screwed for that. Oh. And that it wasn't enough that God judged me for what I did. He judged me for what I thought. That's hideous. I can't keep good thoughts long. I mean, I basically have two movies that run in my head. One's sex and the other's violence. I mean, you know, I can be driving down the street going, "I'll kill him, I'll do her, I'll kill him, I'll do her," right? And I ain't doing nothing except driving across town, man. I just, you know. So when you tell me God's the answer, I'm screwed here. I'm screwed. I'm never going to measure up. I remember sitting in a treatment center, and there was there's a trustee for, it was up in Maine, Waterville, Maine, and it was a trustee from Thomaston State Prison. I listened to him, and he had a great story, and I'm with him, man. I was ready to join AA. Listen to this guy, tough guy. And then he started talking about how he came to AA in prison. He's doing a life sentence, and they introduced, and he found God, and it changed his life. The minute he said he went to AA and found God, I remember sitting there and just kind of sinking down in my chair and thinking, oh, what have they done to him? He's cool. I mean, I drink with this guy. He's cool. What did they do to him? And the truth is, I'm afraid of God. I'm the guy that if I'm afraid of you, I'll find a way to resent you and throw you away. Because I don't know what else to do. That's a pathetic way to conduct yourself, but that's the guy that came here. And so I hear people talking about God, and it's like a steel door slams in my head. It can't be for me. And I'd given God a couple tests. I mean, I remember one time I ended up in this jail cell, and I was up in Maine. And I have one friend left on the planet, this guy Chris Morgan. And I don't know what happened, but I ended up in jail, and I'm sick, and I need a drink. But I know that my buddy Chris is going to get me out, and we're going to go get drunk and laugh about whatever happened. Maybe I got a DUI, maybe it was drunken disorder, I don't know. But it's going to be okay, because I know Chris is going to get me out of here. And the guard comes, and he takes me into this office, and I'm thinking I'm getting out. Instead, this detective's in there, and he's telling me that I'm there because I took a hunting knife with a blade about this long and opened up Chris's chest the night before. And he's saying that, I'm looking at my blue jeans, and they're covered with blood. And I felt like, I tell you, I had this feeling right in here that I was going to start screaming. The horror of it was so unbelievable to me. But if I started, I'd never stop. And I pushed those feelings down in there with everything in me, and I went back. They took me back to that cell. It was an isolation cell. I was there by myself, and I fell down on my knees on that hard floor, sobbing uncontrollably and begging God, don't ever let me drink again. And I got drunk the day I got out. So, yeah, you're going to tell me God's the answer? Yeah, maybe for you. Maybe for you. Good for you. But he don't help guys like me. And I knew that. And I didn't even know that I had a lot of prejudices about God. I didn't know that the book says you only have to do two things to start this connection, to start this process. And the first one is to lay aside prejudices. And I didn't know that. I didn't even know I had them. And all these preconceived notions and opinions and judgments and positioning against God. I didn't even know I was that guy, but I was that guy. And then the other thing, and this is the brilliant thing, is if I could just express a willingness to believe. And nobody in AA, the thing, I kept waiting for the shoe to drop, like you were going to tell me I had to believe something. You never told me that. To this day, you never tell me that, but you do encourage me to take actions. And the actions I may not believe will work, and it seems like you don't care. You just want me to take them anyway. And as a result of taking those actions, things start to happen in my life. And I never knew that what AA was doing very slowly and incrementally is repositioning me in the universe to be able to catch some grace that was my divine right that would change my life. And the grace—it's very much like the wind on a sailboat. You know, you just have to—it's—you just have to learn how to set the sail in order to catch the wind. The wind does not discriminate. The wind does not only push sailboats where the guy didn't play with his tiller too much. I mean, it's not like that. It'll take anybody and provide power to anybody who can learn how to catch the wind. And that's what you guys started to do with me. You started to help me to reposition myself, and I am grateful. And I try to do that with the guys I sponsor. And every time I give the guys I sponsor the directions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I watch them, their life change, it reaffirms, and I go, once again, because I get jaded here, once again I'll go, oh my God, this stuff really does work. I forget, because I'm ashamed to tell you, sometimes I take my sobriety for granted. Of course I'm sober a long time, but it's really a big doing. It's a miracle. Well, I was in and out of these treatment centers where I was building my case against AA, and it made more sense to me to go to psychiatrists. I mean, for they're educated. You know, I got some guy that's a plumber wanting to help me in AA. Come on. I'm too deep for him. So I went to a lot of psychiatrists. My mother worked for mental health. She was a therapist with MHMR in Pennsylvania. And because of her and my dad's influence politically, they got me in to see some amazing psychiatrists. But I don't have a mental disorder. It looks like it. I have a copy of the DSM at home. I understand why they diagnosed me certain things. It looks like it. I would have done the same thing. But it's not. What I have is worse than a mental illness. It's a spiritual malady. And the great hope and test of time and experience in Alcoholics Anonymous comes from a line in the book that is proven true here repeatedly and repeatedly, when it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I'm not the nut job I was when I came here. Now, I ain't perfect, but I ain't the guy that I was when I came here, and will not be that guy again as long as I maintain my spiritual condition. I can stop maintaining my spiritual condition. We all know what that's like. We all go through periods like that. First of all, you start noticing what's wrong with everybody almost instantaneously. Because you're a little restless, you want to tell them because they need to know. And I go from being a servant to a pain in the butt, you know, just like that. And because that's what the ego does, doesn't it? I didn't know that what was killing me was something I was in the bondage of. I had it once. There was a great psychiatrist in Pittsburgh who lectured and worked out of three different treatment centers there, and I was in all three of them. And the third time he saw me, he pulled me aside and started trying to talk to me. He wanted to help me. And he said something to me that I did not understand, but I've remembered it to this day because it was so right on. He said to me, he said, guys like you don't get any better. He said, you may find a way to stay physically dry for years or decades, but you do not change and you do not get any better, because even though you have no self-esteem, you're so ego-dominant that you cannot listen to anyone in order to hear anything new. You can only listen to see how you are already right. Man, I'm telling you, that's me. I don't know that it's me, and it's killing me, but that's me. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. I'm the judgmental. And my ego is so defended that it will tear down and take the inventory of anyone who threatens it. I remember sitting in a meeting in a treatment center, Gateway. They had a speaker come in, and he was a pretty good speaker, and he was starting to hit home a little bit with me. You know what I'm saying? When you're making your little, if you're new and you don't want to be an alcoholic, and he's starting to hit home, and it's getting a little squirmy. And here's what my head did. My head went, "Oh, that's the stupidest toupee you've ever seen, Bob." I mean, and with that judgment, I discounted everything he said. And it's amazing how defended my ego is. I think my ego doesn't care if it kills me, as long as after I'm dead, everybody thinks, "Well, Bob was right, though." You know, I'll tell you a funny little side story. This is sick, but this is a true story. I said these through secret fantasy. Well, I ended up in an emergency room. Not unusual for me. I hurt myself sometimes. I don't mean to, but I fall down. This particular time, I put my fist through a window because in an alcoholic rage because I hated myself and my life and what had become of me, and put that and I tore something open and I was bleeding and it wouldn't stop. So these people took me to the hospital and the doctors stitched me up, and then they took some X-rays just to make sure everything's okay. And I'm sitting there in this waiting room, and I got to wait for the results of the X-ray. So, you know, I've been there a couple hours by now, and unfortunately, they do not have bars in emergency room waiting rooms, you know, or else I could add a drink, but there's no drink. So I'm sobering up in there. Don't want to, but I am. I'm sobering up. My head's starting to clear up a little bit, and I'm sitting in this waiting room, and there's a rack of medical pamphlets, heart disease, diabetes, that kind of stuff. And one of the pamphlets is 7 warning signs of cancer. I saw that pamphlet, and I thought, I just grabbed it and started looking through it. And one of the warning signs of cancer, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like intermittent unexplained bleeding, right? And I'm reading that, and I think, oh my God, you know, I dry heave sometimes when I'm sick and blood comes out. Then I thought, oh, wait a minute, there's been a couple times, Bob, you've been bleeding out of both ends. Oh my God. You got cancer. You got cancer. And I remember thinking about that. I got cancer. And then this epiphany, I thought, it's metastasized to my brain. That's why I do the bizarre things and don't remember them. That's why I fly off the handle inappropriately from a crazy emotional reaction sometimes with people, for they didn't really do much, and I just blow up on them. That's why sometimes I get so withdrawn into me. That's why people don't really like me. I have a brain tumor. And it was a tremendous fantasy. I just used to play with that mentally. I'd sit and drink that cheap wine, and I'd fantasize about how they're going to find out, and they're going to take me to a cancer ward. And my mother and father, who will have nothing to do with me at all, I can't not welcome in their house, they will not take my calls. My mother and father think I'm a bum, and they're going to be notified that I really have a brain tumor, and they're going to be so ashamed of themselves, they're going to run to the hospital. Oh my God, Bob, we didn't know you had a brain tumor. Oh, you're back in the will, Bob. We'll take care of you, you know? And then, of course, all my ex-girlfriends who thought I was a bum are going to be notified, and they'll come running to the hospital properly ashamed of themselves. I loved that fantasy. Then I ended up in a treatment center, and this doctor's doing my vitals and starting to talk a little bit about alcoholism. I said, Doc, I have a brain tumor. He says, "Has this been verified?" "Yes, it has." Well, I mean, it was verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me. I mean, you know, I know, right? I just know stuff, you know? And so he got very excited, and he set me up for a whole bunch of tests. They shot dye in me, put me in one of those tubes, took pictures of me, all kinds of stuff. And I'm waiting, and finally, they call me up to see him, and I'm, you know, they're going to notify my family and everything. I'm just all excited. And he calls me in. He says, "You don't have a brain tumor. You don't have cancer at all. You have an ulcer and a hemorrhoid." And I remember, I was like, I felt so depressed. It was like, I want another opinion, you know? It's like, see, My ego is so out of line that it would rather have me dead and me right and you wrong. I mean, isn't that's pathetic, really? And do you know something? I've known alcoholics that will kill themselves over pride and ego rather than look bad. You know? When it says in our book that it says something very funny. I don't. Sometimes Wilson to me is funny. I don't know if he's trying to be funny. He says that we are extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. Yes, sir. He's not saying, listen, if you're new, he's not saying that you might have a problem with this. He's saying you're off the frickin' charts. Everybody on the planet has a little bit of a problem with self-will, and then there's us way up there running the whole universe. Yeah, we don't think so. That's right. When I remember my first Dick, my sponsor, he had me read page 60 through 63. And those of you that have read that, I'm reading it over and over again. I swear to God, I'm reading it and it's not me. But I could see clearly how it was quite a few people in AA. I mean, the guy wanting to run the whole show is forever trying to arrange the lights. I mean, oh, I could see. Go to a business meeting at your home group. You will see the people in there that are egomaniacs. But I don't think it's me. And in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, Wilson says that we'll be quick to see our defects of character in others before we could ever see them in ourselves. And see, I could see it in you, I couldn't see it in me. But sometimes pain and discomfort will meet spiritual principles and something wakes up. And all of a sudden you're that guy. And I had one of those days, and my sponsor had me go back and read that part of the book, and for the first time in my life it was me. And it was me because I was having a really bad day and I could see it was me. I could never see it was me. I could see it was you. But on that day, I could see it was me. And it was kind of embarrassing because it was not just like I just became this guy. I could see it was me and it had been me all my life and I didn't know it. That's why I sponsor a lot of guys. And, you know, it's usually somewhere between about a year and 3 years. They'll come up to me as I went to my sponsor and they'll say the same thing. They'll say, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I didn't used to be this self-centered. Yes, you were. You just didn't know it, did you? Now you're starting to know it. That's all. You only know what you know when you can know it. And that's part. The part of the awakening is you start to see who you really are. They say the truth will set you free, but I'm telling you, it can ruin your day first. It's like, because some of this awakening is not good news. It's like, I'm a self-centered, selfish, self-indulgent, self-obsessed, self-focused, self-absorbed idiot. That's me. Well, I'll just never be that way again. That's my reaction to the knowledge. I think knowledge is power. Knowledge is not power. I struggle with this stuff today. Matter of fact, you think long-term sobriety would help you with this stuff. I'll tell you, I think it gives the ego more information, more stuff to work with. I've had my ego use everything, use the traditions to grandize myself. I was in general service for about 8 or 9 years, and I was really into it. I was tasked with doing a service manual concept study group, which is a real crowd pleaser. But I did it, and I'm learning about the traditions and the concepts and the service manual. And why am I doing that? Am I learning that really so I can be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a better servant? I used to go to meetings and look for tradition breaks. You know what I mean? Because if I found one, I could lord it over people as if I was, like, I was using it to put me up here rather than to make me a better servant. And I think really that's the point of Alcoholics Anonymous, is for me to become a servant. It's to forget myself. Wilson in his story says the price must be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. But that sucker don't die once and for all. Ego comes back like, grows back like a bad tumor, man. And Thiebaud talks about this in some of his writings about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And we all know that. We've all had that experience. As I have been at times, the most surrendered guy. I'm a surrendered servant, no opinions. I love everybody. I just want to do God's will and be helpful. And 2 days later, it's like this thing turns in my head. And it's like the noticer comes on. Just starts noticing things. Go to your home group. Didn't he hear the announcement about the cell phones? That's your third cup of coffee and you didn't put any money in the basket. Oh, would you stop getting up and walking around the room? Everybody's seen your new set, for God's sake. Stop it. Stop it. Here's the sad part. There have been times when I've been that judgmental guy. And here's the sad part. I don't know that I'm that guy. I think I'm right. Right? And I'll tell you, one of the things, I've stayed in the trenches nonstop since I've been here, and that's in the going to the detoxes and the recovery centers in this place. And I'll tell you, it gives you a different view, because I see the guys in there that are just like me and that have literally judged themselves out of Alcoholics Anonymous one judgment at a time. And here's the sad part. They don't know they're doing it, as I don't know I'm doing it when I'm doing it. Because the ego doesn't tell you that. The ego tells you you're right. They really are. They're really out of line. How do you know if it's you? Wilson said something in Step 10 in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions that is the road sign for ego dominance. It's the road sign that I'm getting spiritually sick. He says that there is a spiritual axiom that when I'm disturbed at all, no matter what the cause, no matter what the reason, there's something wrong with me. If I feel separation and angst and discontinuity between me and you, there's something wrong with me. I am always the guy that must change. I'm always the guy that must do the realignment. The book says it says it's the proper use of the will to align my will with God's. And what is God's will? God's will is. Why am I such an idiot like this? Well, how come I'm the guy who just sees what's wrong with things? And never in my life have I walked into a new job or a new group of people or an AA, anything, and instantaneously noticed the good in everybody there. I've never been that guy. But I'll just watch your body language and I'll see potential problems in some of you. Yeah, he's full of himself, I can tell. And what's that about? Why am I the guy who quits in my first 4 years of sobriety? I went through about 9 jobs. Because it's not long before I find what's wrong with you. Why do I always find problems? I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. It's a problem-seeking missile. It just zones in. It just sees the bad. It sees the potential problems. I'm always in my head trying to clear up the wreckage of my future, and I'm always trying to solve problems that haven't occurred yet. I notice problems where they don't even exist. And Wilson talks about that in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, and it's beautiful. And I think he's funny again. He says, well, we talk a lot about problems. And then he says, why? He says, well, it's because we're problem people. I'm like that little kid in the movie Sixth Sense who walks around and says, I see dead people. I see problems. Everywhere I look, I see problems. Why is that? Well, if everything really and truly was in divine order, then my ego would recess into obscurity. I would have nothing to do. There'd have nothing to play God about. in order for my ego to be dominant, it has to find fault. It has to find fault. You can't play God if God's in order, in charge and everything's perfect. Chamberlain used to say, God, I used to listen to him every chance I could get. He was such an amazing person. And he used to, one time he said, and I was sober maybe 2-3 years, I guess, and he said that he thought the worst thing we said in AA was let go and let God. And I thought, no, that's the best thing we say. And then he said, let God do what? What if he's already done it and you just don't know it? What if your life is already in perfect order and all the problems and angst in your life is an imagining of your ego in order to stay in charge? What if everything is perfect as is? Well, then what would this do? What would it do? Do crossword puzzles? I mean, what would it do? It would have nothing to grind about. It would have nothing to think about, nothing to plan about. It gets a sense of power in running the scenarios. You know those scenarios. You're going to go see your boss. You're already in your head going, well, he'll probably say this, and then I'll say that, and then he'll say that, and then I'll say, right? And there's a sense of power that's an illusion, that it really is in divine order, and it always was. When I was fairly new, this guy Joe Wright, who helped me a lot when I was new, he was a kind of a harsh guy, but I really liked him. He cornered me. I was just out of detox, maybe just a couple days, and he cornered me at this meeting at the old Alana Club, and he says to me, he says, kid, I heard you share in the meeting. Kid, you need to take step 3. And I said to Joe, I can't take step 3. He says, why not? I said, well, the truth is, Joe, I don't believe in God. I don't know if there's a God or not. He said, you don't have to believe in God to take step 3. I said, Joe, look, I pointed to the steps. I said, look what it says. It says, step 2, came to believe. I don't have that. Step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't have that. I can't take step 3. And he said to me again, listen, kid, trust me. You do not have to believe in God to take step 3. He said, I will promise you a miracle. He said, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, and he points to a chair in the Alana Club, instant miracle. I said, okay, what the heck? All right, Joe, I turn my will, my life over to the chair. And he goes, well, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't even get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah, yeah. Because if you'd followed me around and watched me the last couple of years, not just drunk, but even worse, sober, because I make the decisions to drink again when I'm sober. If you'd have watched me, you'd come to the conclusion that whoever's making decisions for Bob is out to destroy him. And yet it doesn't look that way up here. I have this infinite capacity for justification and rationalization and to explain things to me. And the chatter in my head. Do you ever notice how the voice in your head is so reasonable and so seductive? Not like the harsh voice of your sponsor. This is a good voice. This is a voice that says things to you like, well, you don't have to do everything he says. He's old. It says things like, well, they don't want you to go out with the new girl, but they're probably saving her for themselves. You know, it just says stuff. It says it had me quit jobs because it would start talking to me about how they're taking advantage of me and how I'm not getting paid enough and I'm working harder than everybody else until I'd just be up to here and I'd quit. Or I'd have such a bad attitude I'd get fired. Because I'm listening to it. I'm listening. I didn't know that wasn't me. I thought it was me. I had a guy in AA tell me, you're not your head. I said, I'm not? No, you're the stupid guy who listens to it all the time. Right? It's like, wow. I mean, I'm not this. I'm the listener. Wow, that's amazing information. That never occurred to me. I thought this was me. I mean, the greatest trick my ego's ever done is to convince me it doesn't exist. I mean, it's so subtle. And I, in 1978, on my last run, I tried to commit suicide. One of the things that happened to me after that doctor had given me the complete physical and told me I didn't have cancer, he said, you know, you have alcoholism, kid, and you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. But you're young. You're a young kid in your 20s. It's probably going to take 5 more years. And I came to in the park one day, and I'm so sick. I can't, not only can't I get high right anymore, there's no relief in the bag, the bottle, there's no nothing. There's nowhere to turn anywhere. And I know that there never will be, that this, the party's over. And my sponsor says it best. He says, you get to a place where there's no friendly direction. Not even alcohol. And I remember that what the doctor said about 5 years. And I remember sitting there thinking about 5 years like this. 5 years in that pathetic, depressed abstinence. And then intermittently this pathetic, depressing drunkenness, the loneliness of abstinence, the loneliness of drunkenness. And I remember thinking, 5 years. I can't do 5 more days of this. And I made the decision to kill myself. And I tell you something, there was a feeling and a sense of relief in the finality of that. And it was like I was going to get closure on all this crap, you know, and get it over with. And I remember that. And I psyched myself up and went down to this bridge to kill myself. And I got perched on the side of that bridge, and a terror gripped me. And it was not a fear of dying. I'm not afraid of dying. I looked down probably maybe 100 feet below on these railroad tracks at the edge of the river, and I'm looking at those, and all of a sudden the fear is that maybe this isn't high enough. Maybe with your luck, Bob, and it's not like I've been a good luck magnet. He said, maybe with your luck, Bob, you're not going to die. You're going to end up paralyzed from the neck down in some charity ward. You'll lay there for 50 years. Nobody will bring you a drink. All that they'll bring you is new people in AA, and they'll march them through the room, and you'll get to hear the old guys say, well, this is what happens to you if you don't work our beautiful 12 steps. And I'm paralyzed. I can't even give them a one-finger salute, man. I'm laying there just listening to my head tell me what a worthless piece of crap I am for 50 years. That scared me. I think, honestly, looking back, if I'd have known for sure that this would have killed me instantly, I think I'd have jumped. If there was no reservation, but I was afraid. And I couldn't kill myself. And through a bizarre series of circumstances, I ended up in Las Vegas. I wasn't trying to go to Las Vegas. And you know I wasn't going to Las Vegas to get sober. I mean, for God's sakes, if you asked me to make a list of 100 cities I could possibly get sober in one day, Vegas is not on that list. But we are brought together, time and space and people, by divine appointment. And even though I was trying to get to California, I made it to Las Vegas. I was so sick, I ended up in this hospital. And the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And I remember sitting in there, and there was a gentleman who died in December who was my best friend. He was my first sponsor. He was my business partner at 25 years. He was like my dad. But at the time, he was just one of those AA do-gooders. I remember they used to come in twice a week, and I remember just like, what are they up to? I mean, these people must not have a life or something, you know? And I didn't know that what I was observing was the cream of the crop here. See, AA, if you're new, AA is different. It's the only organization on the planet that I know of where you'll come in a big shot and work your way up to servant. And these were servants. These were guys that believed in the primary purpose. And I fell into their hands, and I asked this man, because I identified with things he shared, and I thought I was like him, and maybe he could help me. And I told him, if you'll sponsor me, I'll do anything that you ask me to do. And I didn't realize they have things they want you to do, actually quite a few. And none of them seemed like a good idea, but the amazing thing wasn't that I said I would do what you asked me to do. The amazing thing is when I got uncomfortable and everything in me is screaming not to do it, I did it. And my life started to change by taking actions that ran contrary to the... In other words, what was really happening in me is I was taking my hands off the wheel of my ship, and I didn't even know it, and I was giving it to them. And so they directed me, and some of it was tough. I had to turn myself in and offer to do some prison time. I had to make some amends I thought were impossible. I had to do a lot of service. These people were into 12-step work. I mean, they were not big book technicians. They were amends, God, and helping drunks and taking jobs in AA. They were big on all of that. And it seemed like every time I talked to one of him or one of his minions, they'd always talk about help people, help. You know, they wanted me to sign up for this new meeting in the state penitentiary. They wanted me to take meetings back into the detox I was just gotten out of. They wanted me to sign up for the 12-step list, help people, help people. And, you know, I'm a smart guy, and I've had a lot of therapy. So I said to him, I said, listen, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And the guy rears back and says, work on you? You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. I thought, whew. You know, I have done quite enough of that. I mean, if I could have been fixed, I think I'd have been fixed by now. I mean, I tried everything from primal screaming to, I just did everything. I mean, I was hypnotized, regressed back in my childhood, trying to figure out if somebody had damaged me. Well, you know, I felt damaged. Somebody must have done this to me. You know, I had nothing. I did all that crap. And all I did was get worse and worse. My parents, before they turned away from me, not only did I destroy them emotionally, but I cost them a fortune. They spent a fortune. And the more money and effort they put into trying to help me, the worse I got. The worse I got. And the greatest thing they ever did was turn their back on me and just said, don't call us, don't come here. We don't care. You end up in jail, you're on your own, and that's it. And they kept their word because I called them from jail and they just would not. My dad hung up on me. So I get sober and I got a lot of guilt and a lot of shame for what I did to my mother and father. One of the worst things I did to them is I kept getting back up on my feet again. And they get their hopes up because they love me. And they try to help me. And I just burn it to the ground again and again and again. And I stole so much from my dad, he became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop in the town he lived in from buying his own crap back. And I'd hurt them deeply. My sister told me a couple years before I got sober that even though they cut me out of their life, I guess they couldn't cut me out of their heart because my mother was now seeing her own therapist and taking medication. And my dad was sleeping 15 hours a day. And they became recluses in their own home. And they used to have a big life. They were involved in all the civic stuff, all the charitable stuff. They had a great social life. They were part of the community. And the last several years, they just stayed at home because they couldn't go out and face people because people kept asking them questions about me. And they were worn out. And they couldn't face it. And I knew that I was the catalyst. I did all that. And so I get sober and people... You know, one of the things about getting a sponsor and joining a home group is they start butting into your business right away, man. They say, oh, so how's your mom and dad? Oh, I haven't talked to them in 3 years. Oh, so you haven't made your amends yet, huh? Well, then he started giving me direction, you know. I think you should call your mom. I said to him, I said, listen... You don't understand. It's too late. They won't take my calls. This member of AA says to me something that would have never occurred to me. Don't call collect. Wow. I would have never thought of that. Isn't that funny? That's how selfish and self-centered I am. That would have never occurred to me. Don't call collect. I had this sense of entitlement. I remember the first time I called my mom. Boy, when she heard my voice, she got upset. What do you want? And then she panicked. She goes, oh, my God, you're back in Pennsylvania again, aren't you? I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. You're in Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. She went, you paid for the call? She was like astounded. And then the wall went right back up and she got off that phone quick. But you told me to persist, that amends are not made in one sweep. The book says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And I persisted and I persisted, and our relationship started to change eventually. And you always have been great on the actions. And you've always encouraged me to keep taking the actions, even when I don't, even when I'm discouraged, even when I'm afraid, even when I don't think they're going to work, you keep saying, take the actions. And I'm a three legacy guy. I'm involved in a home group. I'm a member of the Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas. We have four open meetings and five H&I meetings a week. I'm very proud to have jobs there. If you come there on a Monday night, I have two service positions Monday. You'll see me at the door an hour before the meeting starts as a greeter. And if you come Tuesday night and you come early enough, you'll see me as one of the guys setting the chairs up and helping set up the food because we eat before the meeting. And if you come to Vegas several times in the week, and there's an opening, I might take you to a hospital or an institution where I take meetings. Because that's important to me. I have to be a seeker here of people to help. I don't have the luxury of waiting for them to come to me. I saw someone recently who's sober a long time and they're fighting depression. And I said to him, I said, why don't you do some 12-step work? You don't sponsor anybody. Why don't you do that? And they said something to me that was very sad. They said, and this person's sober a long time. They said, you know, I tried that. I sponsored a couple people and nobody stayed sober. So it's not my niche. Do you know, December 15th, 1934, Bill Wilson left Towns Hospital. In a little over 4 months, from December 15th, 1934 to June 10th or May, Mother's Day weekend, 1935, about a little over 4 months, Wilson worked with, one of the estimates I just heard, it says in our literature, almost 100 people. I heard one guy say, they tried to figure it out, and it 96 failures in a little over 4 months. 96 failures. This person did two or three. Hey, you got 93 more. Well, you quit maybe three people before the miracle, because God can't change me if I'm not in that arena, right? That, you know, there's an old adage in AA that you can't keep it until you give it away. I don't think we start to get it until we give it away. God has done more in my life through sponsoring people and doing 12-step calls. I mean, there have been times when I've been really sick and don't know it. But I will be doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'll have one of those awakenings. Do you ever have the experience of listening to a guy's fifth step and he's telling you something that he has done in the past and he's ashamed of it and you're doing it in the present? Right? And you're not even awake to it until that moment. You go, oh my God. Not only have I been doing that sober, I was going to do it next week. You don't get that anywhere else. I'll tell you one more story and I'll shut her down. I was in my 11th year of sobriety. I went through a very, very hard time. I'd been in a relationship for about 6 years, married for 4.5. I had a 2-year-old daughter who I just adored. And I ended up with this divorce. The day after the divorce was final, I found out that the main reason we're getting the divorce is my wife has been sleeping with my sponsee, my favorite sponsee, the whole last year of my marriage. And he was my confidant of my marriage, primarily for my marriage problems. Well, how I got through that was page 66 and 67. But I'll tell you what happened. I'm I have physical custody, or joint, I have joint custody of my daughter, but my ex-wife has physical custody. I'm allowed to see her, but they're living together. And I have to go over to where they're living together to pick her up. And I remember, I know what heartache is, where you ache to see someone. And my daughter's 2 years old, and I just adored her. And I set up an appointment to come over and pick her up and spend the day with her. And I got this knot in the pit of my stomach, and I'm driving over there. And I pull up to in front of where they live, and I get out and I walk up to the door and ring the doorbell. And the happy couple answers the door, for God's sakes. And they call out, "Kate, your dad's here." Kate comes running out, cutest little thing ever. She's 2 years old, just so cute. I take her by the hand. We go off for the day. And, you know, we had a whole day planned around just us together. And the first thing we did is went to a place called Chuck E. Cheese, which I don't know if you have Chuck E. Cheese here. For about $80, you can win a 10-cent ring. It's amazing. It's really cool. And they have a 6-foot mouse that walks around. We spent some time there. And then I had it set up to take her to a friend of mine had horses at the Legends in Concert had a ranch. That show, the owners of the show had a big ranch there, and they had a whole lot of animals. I took my daughter there, and she was very excited to see ponies. She had this thing about ponies. "Oh, I'm going to see ponies, Daddy." And we're going to go there and play with all the animals. And we did. There was rabbits, and she got to feed a lot of stuff. It was a lot of fun. And we got to hold her on a pony, these little ponies, and take her around the crowd. But we had to hold her because she's not very big. And she was, it scared her a little bit, but she would giggle, and she would just really loved it. And we're done riding in the corral, and we're sitting on this picnic bench next to the corral. And my daughter's thirsty. So across the yard next to the stables is a soda machine. So I said to the woman who worked there, hang out with my daughter, and I'll go get some sodas. And I go across the yard, and I'm coming back with some cans of soda, and I hear the woman say to my daughter, "Katie, here comes your daddy." And Katie looks at me and looks at the woman and says, "That's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy." Felt like somebody put a knife up in my rib cage, man. I'll tell you, it was brutal. And I we learn that on the streets, man. You push those feelings down, you know what I mean? Harden up. You put a smile on your face, where alcoholics learn to be actors. And I did that, and I played with my daughter the rest of that day, and I had to take her home. And we drive, she had to be home for supper, and I take her home, and pulling up in front of where they're living. And I get her by the hand, and I take her up to the door, and the frickin' happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms. And I turn around, and I walk back to my car as they're waving goodbye to me, and I get in my car, and I drive about a block away, and I pull over to the side of the road, and I just came apart. And I'm in that car, and I'm sobbing uncontrollably and talking to God at the same time like a schizophrenic. I mean, I'm like nuts, man. And I'm saying to God, "God, I love my daughter, but I can't do this. I'm not big enough for this. This hurts too much. I'm sorry, but I can't see her anymore." And it was breaking my heart, and I couldn't face it one more time. And I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I thought, "Oh my God, I promised this knucklehead new guy I'd meet him at one of the AA clubs and take him across town to a step study, and I don't want to go. I don't want to go meet him. I need to go home and think, for God's sakes." But you guys have brainwashed me. Do what you say you're going to do. Show up where you say, "Oh, Jesus, I'm going to be late." Now I'm racing across town. I get to the SOS club. He's standing in front, pacing back and forth. Get in the car. We start heading across town, and I'm not happy about any of this. And I'm not even in the car with him but a couple minutes, and he starts to break down and cry as he tells me that he had been denied by the courts once again to see his kids. And I'm looking at him, and it's like a postcard from God. "Dear Bob, there's only one person that can keep you from seeing your daughter, and it's you." And I said to myself, looking at him, I said, I'll see her next week. And then the week after that, and the week after that. And she's just turned 27. We just came back from a week in New Zealand together. We've been all over the world. She is the light of my life. And that new guy, he thought I was helping him. I'll tell you something. If you don't show up in our primary purpose, I think you're tying God's hands, because he will work through the people you help. The helper gets all the help here. So if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not identify with me. Not everybody does. Some people just have a drinking problem. You may be sitting here thinking, oh boy, I'm sure glad I'm not like that guy. He's really wacko. No wonder I would drink too if I was like him. Or you may identify with me some. And if you do, I am here to tell you, I'm not here to sell you nothing, but I'm here to tell you square business, that Alcoholics Anonymous is an amazing and effective treatment for this inside sickness of alcoholism that always drove me back to drinking. The bad news in AA is that the treatment doesn't work as fast as 5 shots of tequila. Thanks for listening.
We have a little goodie for you.
Oh, thank you.